and I've got every color thread I could possibly get in New York City, because I was sure that in Gainesville, Florida, they only had two colors. I mean, it's just, I had no idea where I was going. And I went to nursing school there, and I already had a undergraduate degree and a master's degree, but I went to nursing school because I was interested in going into nurse midwifery. Mm-hmm. And while I was in nursing school, I met the women who started the Gainesville Women's Health Center, mm-hmm. and I had worked in New York City at the Eastern Women's Health Center, which is you know, one of the first abortion clinics in the United States, right after Roe versus Wade passed. And so I knew about working in the abortion clinic, and knew what kinds of counseling we did at Eastern Women's Center. And so I started as the head of counseling at the Gainesville Women's Health Center when it opened in 1974. Mm-hmm. So eventually the person who had been hired to be the director of the clinic left, and I became the director of the clinic. But my first job was as the head of counseling and not as the director.
Do you remember how many years or what years you were director?
I was the director from 75 to 78.
Okay.
And then I left in 78 to go back to graduate school to get my PhD in medical anthropology at the University of Florida. Mm-hmm. So it was a wild and crazy time. I loved every minute of it, and it wasn't easy by any means. So I don't know, do you have specific questions about my work at the clinic that you wanted to ask, or do you want me just to sort of talk? Or?
No, I don't have a list of questions. I'm interested, you've already said that you were already interested in nurse midwifery when you went to nursing school. And so you had an interest in these things before you met. I guess it would have been Judy and Margaret and Billy Avery.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and quite frankly, one of the things that happened was that I went out to Kentucky to the Frontier Nursing Service, and they told me, well, you know, you need to be a nurse first. You can't just be a midwife. And so that's why I went back to nursing school. And while I was in nursing school, I met the three of them, but I also discovered that the nurse midwifery program, the closest one, was going to be in South Carolina. Mm. And I just was really having a hard time imagining how I would be leaving my two-year-olds with my husband at the time and go off to something as intense as a nurse midwifery program. So I sort of transferred my interest to women's health, the women's health clinic, as opposed to doing midwifery.
It was very much not just an abortion clinic. That's one thing I've been
gathering. Oh, absolutely. No. We provided well woman care three nights a week, and then we did abortions 2 days a week, and then we ended up eventually doing a vasectomy clinic once every couple of months. Mm-hmm. So we expanded our services after we got our feet on the ground. But, you know, it was a challenging thing because our medical director lived in Jacksonville, Florida, which was an hour and a half away. And we had a local guy. I don't know. I didn't see his name mentioned in any of the transcripts you sent me, but his name was, interestingly enough, Dr. Menzies, M-E-N-Z-I-E-S. He was our backup doctor. But we were very, very, very aware that if we overused him, that he probably wouldn't stay with us for very long. By overusing him, I mean that when women called after they'd had an abortion with a concern about whether they were bleeding too heavily or the pain was too intense or whatever, that if we called him about every single woman who called us, that he'd get tired of it. And literally at the time we were paying him $25 a month to be our backup.
Wow.
So we took an incredible amount of responsibility on our own shoulders and really tried to evaluate as best we could over the phone before we called him, so that we really did not get him involved in most of the follow-up care because we were concerned it would be too much for him. So that was challenging, and it was a lot of responsibility, and I swore after that time that I would never wear a beeper again in my life.
Yeah.
It colors how you can spend your evenings. I mean, you know, you really have to be, when you're on call, you have to be of very sound mind and be able to really evaluate carefully. So, pretty much meant not drinking any alcohol. And it just did color how we could spend our time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of us regretted it, but I think those of us who carried the beeper, which were the nurses, did find that a challenging part of the clinic. And that's something that, you know, Billy and Judy and Margaret just had, like, no awareness of, you know? I mean, it was interesting to read the transcripts because everybody's experience is different. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's 40 years ago, and so many of us may have sort of a halo effect after 40 years, but there were some tensions, and it wasn't as rosy as I felt like some of the people were describing it. There was one quote about, there were no differences, we all got along, we all felt the same about everything, and that was just really not my experience. So some of the tensions that I feel existed was one between the clinical and the non-clinical people, because the clinical people were assuming a very different level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all were getting paid shit. I mean, literally, I, as the executive director of the clinic, I was making $12,000 a year. That kind of gives you some idea about, and of course, it was 40 years ago, so I'm not, saying that, I mean, I don't know what that would be in today's money, but it sure wasn't a lot of money. That's for,
teaching job, I made $10,000, and that was 1974, I think.
Yep.
So, and that was not a particularly responsible job. Nothing like running a clinic.
So that was one of the tensions. Another tension was really between the lesbians and the straight women, and it was. It was kind of amusing. I didn't notice it. Somebody talked about this Southeastern Women's Health Conference that we planned and executed, which was really wonderful. But one of the workshops that we had there was straight and gay women conversation or something. I can't remember what the actual title was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was so popular that we actually did two sessions of it, and it was so successful at the conference that a number of us continued meeting after the conference, just as a sort of an ongoing group to talk about some of the issues. And ironically, or maybe not so ironically, every single one of the straight women, myself included, became a lesbian. So that's what those kind of groups get you. But there were tensions about that, and there were tensions about people who had male children. I had two male children, and there were some events that some of the more radical lesbians really didn't want male children to be there. And, I mean, these children were, like, 7 years old. I mean, I get not bringing, 17-year-old young men to some of these events, but, you know, really, 7-year-old boys? Come on. So there were definitely tensions, and then there, of course, were some racial tensions, and I did see that Deborah David's name was mentioned, and she was an African-American woman who was pretty militant. And, you know, I think we were in a pretty early evolutionary phase of really understanding a lot of the racial tensions and understanding how we needed to be working more on our stuff related to racism. And so one of the solutions to that was to basically change the locks on the front door and get her out, which isn't to me the most facilitative way to handle that. I was not there. I had already moved on to graduate school, but so there are people literally in Gainesville now who will not come to anything that Billy or Margaret might be at because of what happened during that period where the staff got locked out of the clinic. And so it wasn't as it wasn't like we were all totally homogenous and everybody was loving each other. On the other hand, I mean, those of us who worked at the clinic tended to socialize together, even when we were married to men. You know, we kind of drove that, and you know, we'd work all day at the clinic on Saturday, and then, you know, Saturday evening we'd get together with our husbands and children and be all, you know, one big social group. But as things moved along, I think there probably were, you know, people were not all copacetic, which is, I mean, understandable. I'm not trying to paint a black picture of anything, but I did find it amusing when somebody said, oh, we all got along and everything. I was like, oh, yeah? Well, that wasn't my experience. So it was a very interesting and wonderful time, and we all worked really hard. And one of the transitions that happened is the first group of us really all were very committed to the politics of the clinic. And, you know, we literally cared about how many women were on the schedule because we knew that the ability of the clinic to continue functioning required a certain amount of money. As we moved along, in the history of the clinic, more people got hired who were not what many of us would consider staunch feminists, and they saw it more as a job, and the tone shifted a bit. I mean, they were all very nice women, but they were not radical feminists, and they saw it more as a job than as a calling. I think the first group of us absolutely saw it as a calling and a mission and something that, you know, we cared deeply about having those services available for women. After a few years, I think that got diluted, which doesn't mean that there weren't other people who had that philosophy, but those people were maybe more in the minority, and there were sort of shifted to people who, you know, went to nursing school, wanted a job, seemed like a groovy place to work, good job, let me work there, which is, you know, different than the first group.
When do you think that shift occurred? I mean, it was after you left, I think, or was it?
Yeah, it was after I left. Well, I think, it's hard to know exactly what led to it, and there were some kind of unfortunate things that happened. We had two different cases of embezzlement where people working at the clinic embezzled money from the clinic, and I apologize. I am at the tail end, or maybe not tail end, but I'm at the end of a cold, and I'm coughing a lot. So I'm not sure. Just, I mean, part of it, and of course, Billy and Judy and Margaret sort of broke off and started the birth center, so their presence wasn't there anymore.
Was that after you were left, or what?
Yes. Yeah. It was right after they locked the doors and kept all the staff out. That I had already gone. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Billy and I are extremely close friends.
Oh, good.
You know, Judy has died, and I don't keep up with Margaret. But yeah. There are, as I said, there are people who are so bitter about what happened during that time that they would dream of coming. And, of course, Billy comes back to goes back to Gainesville a fair amount to do public speaking. And that caused a lot. So I don't know if that was part of it, or whether just we weren't good about keeping front and central the personal as the political, and the sort of root reasons of why we had the clinic. I mean, it got to be that it was a good thing to have, but not that it was all part of the women's health movement and about women reclaiming their bodies. All of the sort of the philosophy, I think, got watered somewhat along the line. Now, having said that, there certainly were plenty of feminists who continued to work there over the next 20 years, but there were also a lot more people who weren't what I would call feminists who worked there, too. Mm-hmm. So it was a wild, lonely time. Yeah. But, and then, part of the issue, and my partner, who I'm with, and who I was with back then, really one of my first experiences with relating to a woman, it's my current partner, so we've been together like 34 years or 35 years. And we often laugh about, all the consensus decision-making, because literally we would make every decision by consensus, which is such a pain in the ass. I mean, what color toilet paper should we buy? Oh, we've kind of reached consensus on that. It's like, no. No, we don't. I mean, about things that are really important political decisions and strategy, we kind of overdid some of that consensus decision-making, and I think that drove some people a little crazy.
Sure. Do you want to mention, I was thinking in the biographical introduction about you, that we could mention your partner by name, or that you've been with your partner now for that long? I've mentioned that in several other people's introductions. I think I mentioned it in Billy's. Do you want me to mention her name?
Oh, her name is Sarah. Oh, well, actually, her name was Vicky at the time, but now it's Sarah. Her name is Sarah Victoria, and when we moved to North Carolina, she decided to claim the Sarah part of her name, but when we were in Gainesville, her name was Vicky Jarvis.
Jarvis, okay.
And,
okay, and you've been together since Gainesville then?
Yeah, since the clinic. I hired her, actually. She was a counselor at the clinic. And
so you met your partner at the clinic. That's one of the things I wanted to get you to talk about a little bit, about how that clinic served not just as for women's physical health, but you had CR groups, and it was a social and, it was a place where political change happened just because you worked there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we really, as I said, we all socialized together. We all supported each other through, what was going on in the rest of our lives. And, I mean, it was a whole lot more than a job, let's just say that. I mean, I've never had another experience like it where it really, the borders were permeable between the personal and the professional. It was all one.
What do you think? Is it because of the times and the the movement?
Yeah, I think so. I think so because a lot of people who weren't even working at the clinic also, other women who were straight at the time, became lesbians too. Like my best friend Bonnie Coates. She became the director. I don't know if she became the director right after me or two. She might have come right after me. She wasn't working at the clinic. She owned the women's bookstore for a while. Mm-hmm.
And women's bookstores work that way too sometimes.
I'm sorry. Yeah, right, exactly. Yep, and then there were, you know, women who were doing counseling outside the clinic, you know, who were mainly seeing feminists and lesbians. And so there was really quite a movement in Gainesville. It was kind of impressive just how many people, and it was also extremely incestuous. I mean, we all were with, you know, everybody else's partner a few times over. I mean, it was just when we moved to North Carolina, and there's, you know, pretty good women's community here in Durham, but we absolutely are not involved with the women's move.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, we have friends who are lesbians, we have friends who are straight, and we have friends who are men, and gay men, and straight men, but the Gainesville experience was so intense that I think we felt like we needed sort of a break from it. And so we didn't really seek out a recreation of Gainesville when we moved to Durham. Just became friends with lots of different types of people, and some of them are lesbians and some of them aren't. But
you know, Corky Culver talks a little bit about the split in the movement between lesbian and straight, and how closeted Judith Brown was, and apparently Carol Giardina is still closeted.
Oh, really?
Well, I say that. We're not sure whether we should say in the chapter that she was Judith's partner or not. She has a new book, Giardina does.
Does she?
Yeah, but she doesn't come out in it at all, and there's like three pages that have anything to do with lesbians. It's about the women's movement.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's interesting.
It's a good book, though. It's about African-American women in the movement. She's answering the argument that said that they weren't in the movement.
Right.
And she's saying, well, yeah, they were.
Well, Billy is a good spokesperson on that one, because she certainly had her ups and downs in terms of getting other African American women involved, but in the clinic when we we didn't have nearly as many women of color as our clients as Caucasian women, and I think most of us, you know, really paid attention to that. And of course, abortion was still relatively new as an opportunity.
Billy thought that about half the abortion clients were African American, but that they didn't use the other services.
Well, I don't really feel like, I don't remember the demographics well enough. I felt like there weren't very many African American women there, period. And of course, we didn't have a very diverse staff either. I'd say 95% of the staff at least were white women, and very few African American women when I was there. Now maybe it got more diverse after I left, but the first 4 years of the clinic, Deborah was in first. Deborah David was the first African American woman we hired, and and we saw where that went. So then, I'm not sure after that how many other African American women were hired, but I actually was at Deborah's birth. Not at her birth, but the birth of her son. I helped her deliver her baby, and so I was actually pretty close to Deborah for a while.
I asked Billy about that because Pam had written about that, and she talked about understanding the perspective of where she was coming from as a black nationalist and as someone who didn't really know much about white people, and she had a good answer to why Deborah would have thought that white women didn't need the women's movement. That's what Pam said. She said it was because from her perspective, white women, you know, had pretty much what black women wanted, which was freedom and responsibility. They didn't. She didn't see. She didn't see the other side.
Well, she was pretty wrapped up in her own stuff, but Yeah.
I should send you Billy's interview. I've gotten the notes to it, and I mailed them to her, emailed them to her. Her mother died.
She did?
Yeah. I found this out because when I emailed him, she had gone to the funeral or gone down to Gainesville.
Oh, when was that?
It must have been about maybe Saturday, Friday.
Oh, my goodness. We'll have to call her. Her mother was really up there in years.
104.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, wow. Oh, gosh. That's tough for Billy.
Yes. I interviewed her on a day when she had been dealing with hospice care for her mother, so I guess they knew it was...
imminent.
But anyway, I don't want to send you her interview notes until she's had a chance to look at them and make sure they're right.
So how did you, I'm assuming that your sample here is sort of a snowball sample, so how did you get to the first, who was the first person, and how did you get to the first person?
Well, Woman Rights is an organization of lesbian writers, and we've been talking about this since 2009 and making lists of people that we ought to... We started out wanting to solicit memoirs, but people really don't want to have to write their memoirs, but they just don't. But they'll let you interview them. And then, in many cases, it turns into something that's more of a memoir, like Margaret Parrish. Her interview notes, so, you know, the notes I sent her after the interview were not very compelling, but after she got those notes, she added a whole bunch of stuff. So so that was a lot of, maybe half of Margaret's was something she added after the interview. But there's a bunch of Gainesville women that go to Woman Rights. That's why we got such a Gainesville connection.
I'm sorry, say that again?
A bunch of Gainesville women. Corky comes to Woman Rights. Barbara
Ezra.
I see. So there's a strong Gainesville connection there. In fact, we're kind of Gainesville heavy right now. Florida heavy. And we're trying to... the fact that you're living in Durham is good because now we have somebody. Maybe you could say a few things about... We have nothing from North Carolina right now. I know that we've got Mandy Carter lined up for an interview, but it's going to be March or April before we get it.
Well, what we're doing, what I did when I moved to North Carolina, so one of the things I did at the Gainesville Women's Health Center is we started the pelvic teaching program. I don't know if anybody talked about that.
Somebody alluded to it. Tell me more about it.
Well, basically it was we taught medical students. Medical students came over to the clinic in groups of three, and one of us would do an exam on the another one of us, and they would observe, and then they would practice. They would do an pelvic exam and get feedback from us. And so it was a really wonderful program, and the students just, you know, I mean, they actually paid their own money to come, which, interestingly enough, things have really changed since then, but they paid money for us to teach them and to teach them how to do a humanistic pelvic exam and, you know, really involve the woman in her own experience and not just, you know, see her as some, you know, body that they were going to do their thing on. And so then eventually that program in Gainesville got what I call co-opted by the medical school, and they started, it was a series of different things that happened. First of all, they asked us to come over to the medical school and be the teachers, but with a medical faculty person in the room with us. And I think some of us did that once or twice and just really sort of balked at that experience because we weren't really the teachers. We were really more the bodies. And that's totally not what we were all about. But when I moved here to Durham, it turns out that there was a women's health teaching group here. And so I was really excited. And so I joined that group, and that group's still going. And it teaches almost all the medical students in the state of North Carolina and physician's assistants and some nursing students. Wow. And so I think there's probably about 8 to 10 women now in the group. I haven't been in the group in probably 10 years or so. Maybe more than that, 15 years. But I was in it for 10 or so years here. And it's a wonderful experience. It's a really great service, I think, to all women, because these jerks learn how to do a really good exam. And we give them lots of really targeted feedback, like, no way, you're not doing that. You know, you need to, you know, ask the woman's permission before you touch her, and you need to, you know, pull down on the pelvic muscles, the vaginal muscle before you insert the, you know, speculum, and you need to do it slowly, you need to do this, step by step. And the students here, the medical schools pay the group, and the students themselves don't have to pay for it, but in Gainesville, the students paid for it. And I think that's there's not that many programs left, because Billy and I actually went back to Gainesville about 4 years ago and spoke at a program at the medical school about the pelvic teaching program, and now it's been, you know, as I said, co-opted. The medical school actually was the one that does it, and it's more of a standardized patient approach, which I don't know if you know anything about medical education, but more and more they've started this teaching technique of using people who are just regular people as surrogate patients, and they teach medical students and residents all sorts of skills, not just, you know, GYN skills, but how to do a well person workup, and how to a patient history, determine risk for diabetes or heart disease or whatever. I mean, it's pretty general now, but when I was going back with Billy 4 years ago to do that talk, I started doing some research to see, you know, what groups like ours existed today, and there's really not very many. So this group here in Durham is actually one of very few groups that are still doing that. And they're going strong. I mean, they've been, I've been here for 25 years, and it had been going for about 8 years before I got here, maybe 10 years. So it's probably 35 years old as a group. Not the same women, but that's pretty impressive. And
that would have been 1978. 35 years from ago.
78 was 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah.
So, now wait a minute, because we... Oh, 78, right, it's 35 years ago, right. We've been here 25 years, but it was going for quite a while before I joined the group. So, that was a whole... that was a group of, I'd call radical feminists who started that group here in Durham. So when you say you don't have anything going, you know, nobody really has done much about North Carolina interviewing some of those people, the earlier people, like Margie said. And
now, we're only doing lesbian feminist activism. You don't have to have been a lesbian at the time. Like, you know, the fact that you weren't a lesbian when you first went to the clinic, that doesn't matter. But we're not interviewing people who are just activists and are straight and have always been. Kind of limits us. But then they're covered well elsewhere.
Yeah, well, the Margie, whose name I just mentioned, she's actually a psychiatrist, and she's a lesbian feminist and is very active in the American Psychiatric Association as a lesbian feminist. And
okay, give me her name, and if you have her contact information, I'll call her.
Okay, you know what? I'll send you by email her email contact. I'm not sure if I have her. I know Sarah, my partner, has her.
Okay.
Her number, but she's not home right now.
Okay.
I will, because Margie's actually Margie's one of the reasons that we're in Durham. Well, we wanted to leave Gainesville. I was actually giving a paper in at an anthropology conference at the beach, in Wrightsville Beach in North Carolina, and so we took that opportunity to drive totally from one side of North Carolina to another to see if North Carolina was a place we might want to move. And Billy was already in Atlanta and really urging us to come to Atlanta. And it's like, big city, I've already done that.
Yeah.
So we actually came to Durham. Of course, I had been here in college, and a friend of Sarah's knew Margie and said, you might want to just get up with this friend of mine, and she can tell you all about living in Durham. And yeah, she became one of our friends, and she was a big reason that we're here. So,
wow.
Yeah, and then she kind of told me about the Women's Health Group. She wasn't in it anymore, but she was one of the founders. So,
I
think of the early group, most of those women were lesbians, but certainly that's not, I mean, there are lots of women who, I'd say it was more likely that they're not lesbians who are in the group at this point. They don't differentiate. Let's just say that. Some of the women are lesbians, but I think most of them are straight women.
So you grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and then you went to Chapel Hill or Duke?
I went to Duke, yeah.
Okay.
And then when I graduated from Duke, then I moved to New York City, which is where I met my ex-husband. And I had my kids there, and then we moved to Gainesville.
And what year did you move to Gainesville?
We moved to Gainesville in 72, in the fall of 72.
Okay.
And I started nursing school in 73, and the clinic opened in 74.
Okay.
And I was the valedictorian of my class, and the people in the nursing school were like so ready to get me out of there because I was just such a damn troublemaker. And well, part of it was that I was a lot older than the rest of the students. I mean, I was like right now saying how old I was seems so young, but at the time I was like 32, 33, and most of the other students were like 22, and so they all came to me for support and counseling, and when they didn't like what was going on in the nursing program, I got to be the spokesperson for everything that was wrong with the nursing program. So the dean was like, let me get you out of this place. So, but unfortunately for her, I had been chosen to be the valedictorian, so I gave this speech at our nursing graduation, and it was all about how nurses are not the handmaiden of physicians, and I cited Barbara Ehrenreich and, all these people that the people in the nursing school hadn't even heard of before, but they were really ready to get me out of that place, I'll tell you what.
Is that University of Florida or another school?
It's Florida.
Florida, UF, right.
University of Florida.
Yeah.
Just regular bachelor's of nursing program.
All right, that was your RN, and then did you get the PhD there too?
I'm sorry?
Did you get the
I got my PhD in anthropology from the University of Florida, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so when I left the clinic, I went into the PhD program, and then, so Billy and Margaret and Judy used to tease me about all my different degrees, and I was going backwards because, of course, getting two bachelor's degrees and two master's degrees, only one PhD.
Yeah.
So now I teach, one of the things I do, I don't I'm an independent consultant, so I do lots of different things. But one of the things I do is teach a course in empowerment education at the University of North Carolina, the School of Public Health, which, you know, is a makes for interesting watching of basketball games because I have a split allegiance between Duke, where I graduated, and UNC, where I'm teaching. But anyhow, so any other questions or things that you want to know about the clinic or the times or the people or?
Well, I want one thing. There's just one thing I want to go back to. You were with New York Radical Women, and that's, you know, that didn't last very long, so you must have been there at the very early times.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah, I was there in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to Gainesville in 72, and so, I was in New York Radical Feminist from, 70 to 72, and then I was, at that same time, I was working at, well, actually, that's probably not, I was probably more like 70 to 71, because in 72, we lived outside the city. We lived up in a place called Golden's Bridge, which you probably haven't heard of, but, yeah, and then I would ride the train in on Saturdays and work at the Eastern Women's Health Center and ride back at night.
So you must have had your consciousness.
Quite a long day, let me just say. I think I got up at something like 6 and fed the babies because, of course, I nursed with my the twins till they were 3 years old. So I would nurse them and take the train into the city and work all day and take the train back and nurse them and put them to bed and do that. Usually Saturdays and Sundays, sometimes just Saturdays, for about a year.
What year were they born?
They were born in 1970.
Oh, the very year that you joined New York Radical Women, right?
Yeah. I said to just keep my sanity. That and the public radio station were my salvation because, you know, I went from being, you know, a professional person and out doing, you know, work in the world to kind of being at home a lot with two little babies and there's a lot of drudgery that's associated with changing diapers and watching two little kids. So, the New York Radical Feminist groups were really my salvation in many ways. And WBAI, the radio station, was on the whole time, too. And that's how I sort of kept my contact with the world beyond babydom. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, I loved being having babies and being a mother, but it was a big adjustment for me to just be home all the time. So
yeah,
I was happy to have these other connections to the world.
Sure. What did you major in college?
I had a double major in psychology and zoology. When I first went to Duke, I wanted to be a physician.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like one of only a couple of women in all my science classes. It was really pretty segregated. Well, it was really segregated in terms of there were no people of color when I started at Duke. None. Mm-hmm. When I was a junior, they admitted 5 African American students, and that was a huge deal. In fact, they just had a celebration a couple of weeks ago of the first 5 students of color that were admitted to Duke. It was really segregated by gender, too, in terms of science classes. And, you know, a lot of the guys would say to me, well, you're the kind we'd like to marry, not somebody who should be a doctor. I really got discouraged. And and I also wasn't particularly strong in the sciences, so it was tough for me academically. And while I was at Duke, I got a job in the on the psych ward at Duke Hospital, Duke Medical Center, and again, a job I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so while I got involved in psychiatry. I thought, well, you know, psychology is, you know, you don't have to be a psychiatrist. You can be a psychologist. So I sort of switched from being pre-med to getting a degree in psychology. But I already had so many science credits, and that's how I got a dual major. But really, the thing that I was most interested in was psychology. And then I went off to, when I went to New York, I went to the New School for Social Research and got a master's in psychology. So I was kind of heading in that direction. And then really the New York Radical Feminists were, and that experience really got me going on wanting to be a nurse midwife, wanting to be a midwife. And then I got the message that I had to be a nurse before I could be a nurse midwife, so that's why I went to nursing school. I was not dying to go to nursing school, but it seemed like the only way I was going to get to be a nurse midwife. And then the clinic came along, and I changed directions again. So I've done a lot of changing directions in my life. I mean, it all sort of hangs together in some sense of the word, but I've been various degrees of commitment to different disciplines, I guess. And, but, you know, really, the medical anthropology has really served me well, and my nursing degree has opened a lot of doors, even though I'm not, if someone's life depended on me starting an IV, they would be dead in 3 seconds, because I'm really not a clinical nurse at this point. I haven't, since the clinic, I have not worked in clinical nursing.
What did you do as a medical anthropologist? Was it teaching or?
Well, I've done some teaching. Really, I see myself sort of as a cultural broker, helping the healthcare system understand the cultural beliefs and practices of the clients that they're there to serve, so that they weave their message into the cultural context of the patient rather than asking patients to do things that don't work in their own lives. So one of the things I did in Gainesville is I was employed by the family medicine program to take medical students out on home visits so that they would see how their patients lived, because and they would make recommendations like, well, you need to take a sitz bath. And it's like, these people don't have running water. How are they going to do a sitz bath? You know, it's just like, well, they don't have a bathtub. Or they don't, they don't have heat, or they don't, and so it was really eye-opening for them to go out and visit the patients on their own terms, and not just what they saw of the patient when the patient came to clinic. So that was kind of a fun job, and so yeah, I've done different things. I do a lot right now of developing curricula and training, doing a lot of workshops for physicians or PAs or nurses around different health issues or different ways of communicating. If you're a medical anthropologist and you're not in academia, you pretty much have to do a lot of educating of potential employers about how you might be able to help them, because most people don't put a sign up saying looking for a medical anthropologist. So you have to kind of help them see how you can offer something to them or be an asset to their team. Now I'm trying. My partner, more than me, is trying for me to slow down and do less work, because I'm 69 now, and you know, a lot of people my age are retired, but I I'm not ready to just not work. So I'm trying to slow down. I'm not real successful at it, but I'm helped in that process by the fact that I have 4 grandchildren who I take a lot of responsibility for taking care of. So that helps me slow down in terms of not working outside the home, because I'm working inside the home taking care of them. And unlike raising twins, these children are, you know, different ages, and so they're different developmental stages. I was just saying to one of their mothers yesterday that, you know, twins, I mean, mean, people think twins are so hard, but twins are in the same developmental stage, so they kind of track each other. But when you've got an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old, they're all sort of in different places, and what one will be happy doing for 4 hours, the other one will last 10 minutes doing. So they're keeping me young, let's just say that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, I love it, but it's, it's a lot. In fact, my sister was visiting recently, and they happened to be here, and she said, when they left, she said, "Wow, that's a lot of energy in the house, isn't it?" And I said, "It sure is."
Right.
A lot of energy.
Yeah. A lot of my friends are doing it. Yep. I wanted to check the spelling of your partner's name. Sarah with an H?
No H.
Okay.
And I was known as Betsy David when I was at the clinic. I noticed in a few different transcripts that's how people referred to me. I only sort of reclaimed my first name when I got divorced. So
that's the boy's last name. Your son's last name is David.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So Randall's your birth name.
Yep.
Okay.
My name is Betsy Randall, then I got married, and I just dropped, but anyhow, I dropped my maiden name and just went to Betsy David, and then when I got divorced, I hyphenated Randall.
Well, when did you get divorced?
My official name.
Was that while you were at the clinic?
No, I was still married the whole time I was at the clinic, and just was Betsy David then. But then I changed them. Well, I got divorced officially when the boys were 13, and I left the clinic when they were 8. So for 5 more years, I was still Betsy David, I guess. And then when I finally did get divorced, I mean, it was just really a formality. I mean, I was living with Sarah, but I still was. Still was married, and then my ex-husband wanted to get married, and so we needed to get divorced. So that was the impetus for changing my name. I wanted to have some name that point of identity with my kids.
Sure.
So both of my guys are here in North Carolina, and they're both district attorneys, elected officials.
Wow.
Yeah, and they their districts are conjoining districts. One of them has 2 counties, and then the 3 counties on the side of those 2 counties are the other guy's districts. So.
That worked out.
They're a lot of fun. I love being around them now. We're very close. And so then one of them had 3 kids, and one of them has 1 1/3 kids. So we're going to have 1 more baby in our family, and I think that'll be it. We'll see. But
that's
a lot of little children around.
Well, okay. I think I have plenty here. I'm going to.
Okay.
I'm going
good.
To.
Well, so you're going to type up the transcript and then send it to me? Is that how it
works? Yes, and it won't be an official transcript, word for word, everything we said.
Uh-huh.
I will, you know what I forgot to say at the front of this tape? I'm going to have to add it to the front. This is Rose Norman. I'm interviewing Elizabeth Randall David on February 25th, 2013, by phone. I hate it when I forget to say that. Because we are going to archive these audio tapes at Duke. They have the Sally Bingham Center.
Great.
So we've got that release form was for that. But we need a grant to get somebody to do the official transcripts. It takes a very long time. Like it would probably take.
Believe me,
hours.
I know.
But what I will do is I'm going to transcribe my notes. I've been taking notes while talking to you. And then I will rearrange things in such a way that I think it would make it read well.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll send that to you. And I can send you a CD with the audio if you want to listen to it. But I will listen to audio in places where I knew you said things I wanted to write down, but I couldn't write fast enough.
Right. Uh-huh.
So it's sort of a hybrid. It's not a transcript, but it's a fast way of getting to what we can use published.
Uh-huh. And what are you thinking that you'll have something together to publish?
Well, we have a November 1st deadline for the spring issue of Sinister Wisdom, but we've already got one issue is 35,000 words, and we've already got about 50,000 words, so I talked to them about that, and they said, well, send us what you have in May, and we'll tell you whether it can be a double issue or not. So Sinister Wisdom is our immediate publication for this time next year, but we've also got a publisher, a lesbian publisher, who we figure anything we don't publish in Sinister Wisdom, that's where it's going to go. So that's been our driving.
Looks like you have a lot of work cut out for you.
Yeah, but it's fun. I enjoy it. There's a lot of us working.
I'm sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sounds great.
Yeah, it is.
Alrighty. Well, I will look forward to getting something from you, and I know that you have a lot going on in your personal life, so I'll just get it when I get it. And
you'll look up Margie's information. And
yeah, I've made myself a note, and I'm pretty good about follow-up, so okay. I will send you Margie's email and phone number. And then she has people she could hook you up with, too, in terms of that original group.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Some of them stay in touch. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, Rose, it was really fun to talk with you, and I'll look forward to seeing